Welcome to the Savvy Dentist Podcast with Dr. Jesse Green, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Listen in each week as we bring you an inspiring person who will share their story, ideas, and business techniques to help you create a practice and a life you love. And now introducing your host, Dr. Jesse Green.
Welcome back to the Savvy Dentist Podcast, the show where great dentistry meets great business. Jesse Green here at the control panels, and today we are picking up part two of our two-part series regarding how to scale your practice. And it's going to be following on from part one, which we recorded last week. So if you haven't had the opportunity to listen to that part, I would suggest you go and listen to it first before listening to this particular episode. Now, before we get into part two of our episode, just a couple of public service announcements. For those of you who are new to our podcast, I just want to bring you up to speed with a couple of resources to help you. And the first resource is the Savvy Dentist app, which you can find on the Apple App Store for iOS, obviously, and the Google Play Store if you're an Android user. So that particular app has all our stuff on there, blogs, podcasts, and we've got a heap of stuff we're going to be adding to that platform as well, some resources there for you. In addition to the app, please feel free to come and join us at the Savvy Dentist Facebook group if you're a dentist. It's a dentist-only group, and we can continue the conversation there. And of course, we've got training tips and tools in there as well to help you grow a practice and a life that you love, which is really what this whole caper is all about. So in our last episode, we spoke about scaling a practice. And just to give you a bit of a recap on one or two key elements around that, what we're really talking about is how to create a practice and a life. It's about transitioning from an operator-style business to an ownership-style business. There's really four kinds of practices that I come across all the time. There's the unviable type of practice, which is a practice where the business owner might be working either part-time elsewhere, or maybe the business is barely breaking even, maybe it's making a bit of money, but not much at all. And ultimately, the practice owner in that situation is working pretty hard for not a lot of return, and it does feel a bit like they're running a charity. So the next level up from that is a profitable practice. And as I mentioned last week, a profitable type of practice is one where there's can be a little bit of profit or a lot of profit. But the key determinant here is that ultimately, no matter how much money the practice makes, how much revenue it generates, whatever the profit is, the business owner is still tied to the practice. And what that means, of course, is that there is a key person risk element in here. And what it means is that if the practice owner goes on a holiday, the bills keep coming in, but the revenue doesn't. And really, the thing that unites this type of practice, the profitable practice and the unviable practice, is they are both key person dependent. And what we want to be able to do in this particular series is explore how to go to the next two levels, which rather than being key person dependent, are systems and team dependent. And the two levels above the profitable level is the first one is a scalable practice where the business owner becomes unshackled from the day-to-day need to generate revenue. And the currency in the bottom two levels is really about money. It's like a hierarchy of needs. And in the upper two levels, the currency is money and time. And it's that time that gives you the freedom and the flexibility to enjoy your life. So above the scalable level is the valuable level. And what we're really talking about here is creating value over and above the revenue streams that the practice produces. And this is really all about legacy. So if the unviable practice is about charity, the profitable practice is really about having a job, the scalable practice is like having a true business, and of course, valuable practice is about legacy and meaning. And as I mentioned, that the value of a practice is typically calculated by multiplying the earnings by a multiple, and that multiple is reflective of the risk in a practice. And when you create a scalable practice and a valuable practice, you've managed to de-risk it significantly. And that's really what we're all about, is removing key person risk in particular. So those are the four types of practices. And really, the bottom two levels, as I mentioned, key person dependent, to get that level of profitability, and there's nothing wrong with a profitable practice if that's what you want to do. It's the traditional practice management paradigm. And if that's what you want to do, then that's totally cool. That's fine. But there is a trend these days to want to transition to true business ownership. And between those two practices is what we call the leverage line. And to move beyond a profitable practice, we need to understand that what got us to profitable is usually exerting a considerable degree of control over just about everything in the practice. So you'll see the practice owner's fingerprints just about on everything. They're the octopus. There's one brain and eight arms controlling everything. And so really that degree of control is actually what we've got to be able to give up strategically to transition to the next level, which is scalable and beyond. But the key word there is giving up control strategically so that we're not just exiting and ejecting. We're putting in place the infrastructure and the architecture so that the business can, of course, continue on to in terms of thriving, in terms of growing, but not requiring us and a personal exertion to generate the revenue. So what I wanted to talk about, again, is this process of going from profitable to scalable, as I described last week, it's a bit like changing gear. It's driving from Sydney to Melbourne in second gear, and what tends to happen in an operator-style practice is you'll be able to stay in second gear, but the engine will start revving. You'll get faster and faster, but you'll get to a point where one of two things needs to happen when you're driving that car. One is you need to either change gear so you can continue to accelerate, or you're going to need to take your foot off the accelerator a little bit so that you don't burn the engine out. And of course, in business, that engine is us. That's the business owner. And so what most people do when they get to this profitable level and they know that they want to scale, they understand the concept of scaling because it's one of those things that is simple to understand but definitely not easy to do. And so they get halfway through this gear change, they feel a little bit like they're in no man's land, so they retreat to what they know and they go back to a profitable style practice. And of course, what happens over time is you see it regularly with older practitioners where they've run their practice down over time. They've stayed in second gear and they've taken their foot off the accelerator a bit, then a bit more, and then a bit more. And of course, ultimately over time, the practice stops performing that well. So we want to avoid that. So when we spoke last week, I outlined the scaling framework really has four key parts to it. And the first part is to really build assets. And we went through a lot of that in detail in our last episode. The second part to building a scalable practice, the second part of the framework, is to create a self-managing team. And of course, we want to be able to have a team that can operate in our absence, it can operate independently, it can add things to the mix rather than just doing what they're told. We want a team that brings their best. We want them to bring their hearts and their minds, and we want them to bring their best energy, their creativity, their ideas, their inspiration, and that way the practice will thrive. The practice will do much better when we get the best out of our team, which of course makes sense, but again, it's simple but not easy. Beyond a self-managing team, the other two elements of the framework are to have a really robust strategic plan. And it's that whole saying that if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. And a strategic plan is one which really looks at the long-term vision and then the short-term things that need to occur in order to get us there. And we'll talk about that in a bit more detail. And of course, the fourth part of the framework is consistent execution. The ability to get stuff done is just key. And consistent execution is a major strategic advantage. And if you look at the best practices, their ability to get stuff done quickly is what separates them from the rest. And so we're going to talk a lot about that as well. But before we get into the other elements of the framework, I do want to talk a bit about the self-managing team because I think this is a really key part. And intuitively, we all understand that building a team is fundamental to our success. We all understand that if we can get some leverage of other people's time, that brings a lot of value to the practice. We understand that if our team are engaged and enthused, it makes a tremendous difference to patient outcomes. And of course, that leads to commercial success. And we also understand that staff turnover is a productivity killer. So our job as business owners is to be able to find A players and immerse them into a world-class culture. That's really our job as the business owner. And of course, our key customer becomes our team in a sense. And our whole ethos is that if we can build a great team that provides great care to our patients, the patients will support our business and the business, of course, in turn supports us. So if our job as business owners and leaders is to find our players and immerse them into a world-class culture, it makes sense then that we need to be able to create culture by design rather than by default. And you see, the challenge for most businesses, not just dentists, but for most businesses is that every business has a culture, but it hasn't been created with any specific intent. It hasn't been designed. It's just been allowed to evolve. And that's rather a shame because anything can happen. So what we want to be doing instead is we want to be on the front foot. We want to be thinking, how do we create a culture that supports excellence? How do we create a culture that supports our vision? How do we create a culture that brings the best out of people? And so really what I wanted to introduce you to was the Culture Telescope. And the Culture Telescope really is a series of lenses. If you imagine the old Pirates Telescope, I'm an ex-Navy dentist, so all things nautical are enjoyable to me. But if you imagine Pirates of the Caribbean and you've got the pirates, they're looking through their telescope into the distance, you can see that telescope is a series of lenses. And of course, lenses magnify and they sharpen focus. And what we want to be able to do is use a series of lenses to create culture. Now, the first lens in the Culture Telescope is really getting clear about our values. What are the things that make us tick? What are the things that are important? And getting clear about values sounds very easy. And the word values is a word that gets thrown around a lot these days. And I think, I don't mean that as a criticism. I think it's good because there's this increasing awareness around values. And the benefits of having a values-driven business is really profound. And you've got companies like Levi's, for instance, who believe that being values-driven is a strategic advantage for them. But ultimately, understanding the values of your practice is key. And of course, you can say that it's a top-down type of activity. And for many people, it does work that way. But we've found that if we can engage the team in articulating and defining the values of the practice, we get better buy-in because they've created that as well. A really good resource around that is a book called Managing by Values by Ken Blanchard and Michael O'Connor. I don't want to articulate their process for you on this podcast because it would take a very long time, but it's a really good book to read and it's a really wonderful process. But needless to say, getting values clear in your business allows you to be authentic, it allows you to be congruent, and that provides a lens through which to make decisions. It gives you a sense of true north. And does this align with our values or does it not? It gives us a great tool for discussing behavior of team members because anytime there's conflict, your values become the reference point. Whether something is out of alignment with our values is going to be a really important conversation to have, because if we don't address that, there's a great saying that you get what you tolerate. And if we walk past things and we tolerate things, then we run the risk of our culture being eroded at the very foundations, which are values. So if there are things happening in the practice that are out of alignment with the values, then we need to address that. So the first lens is values. The second lens of the Culture Telescope is the vision of the practice. And this really, in conjunction with the values, provides the clarity. Where are we going? What do we stand for? And being clear about the vision is absolutely key, because no one really wants to go to work for drudgery. By and large, people want to buy into something. Yes, people need a paycheck. We get that. But equally, people want to feel like they are doing valuable work, that they're inspired, and they want to be making a difference in the world. And that's a fairly fundamental human need. It's not just a case of, yeah, I'll just turn up from 8 to 5 to get the paycheck. Yeah, of course, there'll be some people like that. But by and large, most people want to do stimulating and rewarding work, and engaging people with the vision of your practice is one way of really helping them become part of the fabric of the practice. So the third lens in the Culture Telescope really is around stories. And if you look at cultures that have a winning culture, or I suppose teams that have a winning culture, I should say, the team that springs to mind for me, and as an Australian, it really does break my heart to say this, but the All Blacks rugby team are an incredible team. They're probably the most successful sporting team on the planet, and their win ratio is just outstanding. But what you might not realize is that in the 1990s, they were at risk of really falling apart. They'd lost their way, their culture was eroded. And what they had to do is to rediscover what it meant to be an All Black. And the philosophy of the All Blacks is to leave the jersey better than you found it. And they believe that good men make good All Blacks and good All Blacks make good men. And of course, that is the same for the women's rugby as well. But what they found is that if you looked at the All Blacks, if you think of some of the rituals, which we'll talk about in a minute, they had a lot of Caucasian players, they had a lot of Polynesian players, they had the Maoris and so on, and there was this disconnect because there was these different groups of people. And so with rituals such as the haka, which I'll discuss in a moment, the Caucasian people in particular felt disconnected from it because it wasn't their ritual. So what they found is by sharing stories around culture, sharing stories around background, it united the team. So sharing stories is what brings connection. And stories that connect is really, really important. So with your team, it's about getting to know your team. It's about understanding where they're from. It's about things that are important to them. And really sharing stories about the practice as well. And those stories create connection. So the fourth lens of the culture telescope, I've already mentioned it, is rituals. And of course, coming back to the All Blacks, the haka, which I've already mentioned, is a fundamental ritual for those guys, and it unites them, it gets them ready for battle in inverted commas, and it really does allow them to focus together. So rituals in the practice could be things like the morning huddle, it could be celebrating wins, it could be celebrating birthdays, it could be, you know, whatever it is, but there's these rituals that happen anyway. And what I'm suggesting that you do is you choose the rituals that support the culture that you're trying to create. And of course, from rituals comes behaviors, the day-to-day behaviors. And I've already mentioned a moment ago that what you walk past is what you accept. And another way of saying that is that you get what you tolerate. And so behaviors, the day-to-day activities of the team members, are the final lens of the telescope. But really, the foundation starts with values. And if we were to look at our telescope, you know, we can extend it out like you would see a pirate on a ship. But if you were to take a cross section of that telescope, it would be a series of concentric circles. And the middle circle would be values, then vision, then stories, then rituals. And finally, on the outside, you'd have behaviors. And so it's an inside out type of culture creation process. And it really begins with values. So I'd really commend that to you. So of course, we've spoken about the fact that our role as leaders in the business is to find A players and immerse them into world-class culture. And I've just given you a framework and a process for creating that culture. But how do we find A players? How do we find the right people? How do we find the talent? And there'll be some people listening to this podcast who live in regional areas, and they'll be going, yes, indeed. How do you find the talent? Because sometimes the talent pool can be a bit shallow. And what we're trying to do is to compete with other businesses to attract the best and brightest people to our practice. So let me just run through a couple of things here that will help you find the very best people for your team. And the first thing I would say is it begins with creating an avatar of the type of person you want to employ in your practice. And what that really means is that what are the ideal characteristics of this person? And this really comes back to a talent map. A talent map is, you know, understanding the personal qualities that you might be looking for in terms of attitudes, in terms of views and values and so on. It might come back to skill sets. What are the particular attributes in terms of their capability that you're looking for? But you want to make sure that you've got a clear picture of who it is you're trying to recruit into the role. And once you've got that picture, it's a bit like marketing. And it's really important to understand the similarity between marketing, because we are trying to attract a certain type of person as an applicant, just like we'd be trying to attract a certain type of patient if we're marketing. So having that avatar for marketing is one thing. Having it for recruitment of team members is another, and it's just as important. So once you've got your avatar, what we want to be able to do is to write an advertisement that speaks to that avatar. And we want to be able to write an advertisement and understand that it's sales copy. We're pitching for the very best talent. So we want to create an ad that speaks to the hopes and aspirations of the applicants, and so that we can help them understand that this role is going to be a good fit. Now, when you've got clarity about your avatar and you can write a compelling advertisement, the beauty is it's going to be much more targeted. You're going to attract better applicants. You might get fewer applicants, but you'll get better applicants. And it's also really, as I said, incredibly important to understand that this is marketing for people. It's not just bung an ad up on Seek or whatever platform you choose to use, whether it's Indeed or otherwise, but it's not just throw an ad up. It's not just an off-the-shelf ad. It's got to be done with some thought. It's got to be done with some consideration. And things like video ads and all those sorts of things become quite popular as well. clearly we need to have a process for interviewing people. And for me, an interviewing process can be done over a couple of steps, and it's all about understanding the person that's sitting across the table from me, and I'm trying to make an assessment of, does this person fit our culture? That's, for me, the biggest thing of all. If I can find someone who fits our culture, who gets us, who understands us, who, you know, values the same things that we value, and as long as they're relatively competent in certain fields, I can train a lot of things. So I'm looking in the interview process to use scenario-based questions and, you know, what would you do if type of questions for me to determine what their values might be and get an insight on how they'd handle certain circumstances and how they would behave under certain situations. And then, of course, once we've found some good talent, we need to understand that it's likely that this good person sitting across from us has other opportunities available to them. Most good people are not short of opportunities. And so what we need to be able to do is we really need to be able to create a situation where we've got this magnetic job offer. And again, it's being able to pitch to them, and it's about being able to sell them on the job. And so we have a framework around that called the magnetic job offer, but really it's about understanding what the applicant wants from a role and crafting our offer to address that. It's very, very important. And then we can do a couple of little tests to make sure that we've understood them and to make sure that we can address that for them as best we can. So the magnetic job offer is great, and once we've found that right person, we of course need to set them up for success. And the way we start someone at the outset is going to be fundamental to how they continue beyond that. So the onboarding process is critical, and getting someone up to speed. It's the analogy, to come back to the motoring analogy I started with earlier. It's like joining the freeway. You've got that on-ramp. You want to get someone up to speed so they can move with the traffic easily. And what that onboarding and on-ramping looks like is having an onboarding document where you outline the expectations, the culture, policies, and so on and so forth. But it also involves having your clarity around the role. Most people, in my experience, come to work wanting and believing to do a good, they do a good job, and really, no one I know really goes to work wanting to do a poor job. What happens, though, is where there's frustrations down the track is if we haven't been clear about the role and the expectations and the deliverables up front. So when you onboard someone, that's the time to be very, very clear about not just the position description, but how someone can do well in that role. So going back to university, of course, it would have been great to have had the exams the night before, of course. That would be terrific. If someone said, this is how we're going to score you, here's how it works. And indeed, I've got a daughter who's high school age, and you know, when she does her high school assignments, they get this marking rubric, which is fantastic because the teachers are saying to the kids, you know, this is how to get your marks. If you do X, Y, and Z, you'll get the marks. And so really, you know, part of the help we provide our kids at school is helping them work within that system so they understand what's expected of them. And it's no different with our staff. So what we want to be able to do is to give them a scorecard which outlines the objectives of their role and the key results, which will, when those metrics are true, will mean the objectives have been met. So objectives and then key results, and then finally activities which support the key results. So if we read down the page, you'd start with objectives, you know, which are the big picture, broad brushstrokes, and we know the objectives have been achieved when certain key results or KPIs have been met, and yeah, they're typically numerical. And then beneath that, the activities that support the achievement of those KPIs, which we call critical drivers, those activities, is really what forms the basis of a scorecard. And so having a scorecard is really important because it's like giving the new team member the exam paper the night before the exam or 6 months before the exam. So they know that if they hit these benchmarks, if they hit these results, then they're doing a good job. And again, it comes back to the clarity piece. And it means for us, we're getting what we need done. And for them, if they want to be considered for pay rises or anything like that, they've demonstrated a capability. And that's fantastic for all people, of course. That's wonderful. So, of course, we've now gone through the process of hiring and onboarding, and where appropriate, training them. We also need to have a process of managing people. So one of the frameworks I really like to look at in this context is a thing called the performance culture matrix. So it's like a quadrant, which of course as dentists we're all very familiar with quadrants. And if you were to plot performance on the vertical axis and culture fit on the horizontal axis, in the top right quadrant, you'd have someone who's a great performer and a good culture fit. And that would be an A player. And our job is to understand that we want our A players to stay A players because people can move around on the performance culture matrix. And so if you've got an A player in your team, our job as leaders is to keep them there. And that means making sure they stay in alignment with the culture, making sure they continue to perform, and rewarding and recognizing them. And of course, in the bottom right quadrant, we've got a B player. And a B player is someone who gets us, knows us, likes us, and is on board with what we're trying to do, but there's a bit of a gap in terms of their competence or their skills in terms of the role that they're completing. And so to go from a B to an A, it really comes back to training, skills development, and upping the degree of performance in a role. It's important to understand that someone could be an A player in one role. In other words, let's say you've got a dental assistant who's a really gun dental assistant. They're terrific. And then you move them into another role. Maybe they go into a reception type role, for an example. And they're still a great culture fit, but because they're in a new role, they're not as competent in that role. And so they might go from an A player to a B player when they switch roles. And I think that's really important to understand. The third quadrant, which is the top left, is the C player quadrant. And to be honest with you, this is the hardest quadrant of all because these people are really competent in their role. They're able to execute on tasks. They get the job done well and consistently. The only issue, and it's a biggie, is that they're not the best fit culture-wise. They can be a bit of a square peg in a round hole. Now, this doesn't mean they're a bad person. It's just a matter of fit. And so the key thing to understand around this is that it's going to take conversation and coaching to check and see if we can get a culture fit there. And the thing with C players is, as an owner, these are the ones that we typically struggle to deal with because we worry about losing the skill set. We worry about losing the competency in the role. So we put up with things that we wouldn't otherwise put up with. And the risk in doing that is that it erodes our culture. And it can mean that the culture changes such that A's and B players might leave because the culture changes such that they're no longer a fit. So we've got to be able to address C players very, very carefully and very, very promptly. The risk with a C player is that their performance can then suffer and they become a D player who is neither a culture fit nor are they particularly competent in their role or executing their role well. And with a D player, well, really it's about liberating them to an opportunity outside of our practice. And I sound glib when I say that, but I mean that with kindness because no one really wants to be in a role that's not stimulating, not rewarding, and not giving them what they want. So A's, B's, C's, and D's. So A player, just to recap, great culture fit, great in their role. B players, great culture fit, got some skills to develop, need some training to go from B to A. C's, very competent, but square peg round hole, need to be dealt with so that culture is preserved and not eroded. And the way to deal with that is to have what we call a necessary conversation and provide some coaching around that to see if we can get some alignment. And if not, then maybe we need to look at finding someone else to complete that role who is a culture fit. And then the D player, neither a culture fit nor particularly good performer. And as I said, it's about liberating them to other opportunities. So again, remembering that fit or otherwise does not imply whether someone's a good person or a bad person. It just comes back to suitability for the role and suitability for the practice. So those are the tools that we use routinely in our practice to give us a direction as to where we're going. So if you were to plot that performance culture matrix, you could look at all the people on your team and determine whether they're A's, B's, C's, or D's, and give yourself a bit of a clue as to how you might look to migrate your B's and C's to A's and what to do with the D's. So just some thoughts there for you. So that's the second part of our scaling framework, creating a self-managing team. And I've gone through that process with you this evening. The third part of the framework really comes back to having a strategic plan. Now, strategic planning is a topic that you could spend years and years studying, learning. Theses have been written on the subject. MBAs are full of this sort of stuff. But I take a very simple approach to strategic planning. And for me, I like to keep it simple and back to the basics and the bare bones of what's going to get me from A to B. I want to be like a Formula One car that has everything that's necessary, but nothing that's extraneous. So you're not going to see a Formula One car with a cigarette lighter or an ashtray or a CD player because they strip that stuff out. And that's really what I want to think about in terms of strategic planning. Because as I said, what we're looking for here out of a strategic plan is clarity and focus. Clarity and focus. And if you can get clarity, you are so far ahead of everyone else, I guarantee it. So again, coming back to the strategic plan, really what we're coming to look at again is those objectives, key results, and activities on a practice level now. What are the big objectives that support the vision of the practice? What are the key results that we know those objectives will be, you know, met by? And what are the activities around that? And then, of course, an incredibly important part of that is SWOT analysis: strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats, which is very commonly used. And I'd say putting some deep thought into this activity, again, is not such a common occurrence. Most people don't take the time to actually sit down and write about this. You might grab 2 or 3 minutes between patients or in the evening or whatever, but very few people have the discipline to go through and do this exercise from top to toe. And that is spending good quiet time critically thinking about these questions and coming up with answers that you can then evaluate later. Now, following on from SWOT analysis is also risk analysis and risk mitigation. And I mentioned to you earlier that the multiple, when it comes to determining the value of a business, the multiple is a massive reflection of the degree of risk in a business. So risk mitigation is, I think, a really overlooked part of business planning for just about every dentist I know. And so when we ran our retreat at the end of last year, we ran an intensive, and part of the activity we did was to identify risk and put together a risk mitigation plan. And we spent a good 45 minutes of critical thinking, quiet time. Really, you could hear a pin drop in the room, actually. It was really quiet. And you know, the attendees went through this process of identifying risk, quantifying risk on a risk matrix, and then, of course, looking at ways to mitigate risk. And risk mitigation really has a couple of key parts to it. And the first thing is, how do I reduce the probability of this particular event occurring? If I've identified a risk, how do I reduce the probability of it occurring? The second one is, how do I reduce the impact or the cost of it should it occur? And the third one is, what can I do to gain more control over the situation? So when you're going through this process, a couple of things to think about when you're looking at strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. So any opportunity that comes up, it's really important to run that through the matrix of, does this move me closer to my goal? Does it move me closer to my vision? Because one of the things that I've observed is we can be attracted to shiny and bright stuff. And sometimes when those shiny and bright things come along, they look fantastic, but they can be a massive distraction. So here's my question for you. Anytime an opportunity comes along, the questions you want to be asking yourself is, what's the upside? What's the opportunity? What's the upside of the opportunity? What's the downside of that opportunity? Can I live with the downside? And can I mitigate the downside? So that's kind of bringing the SWOT analysis and the risk analysis together. So anytime you have an opportunity, what's the upside? What's the downside? Can I live with the downside? And can I mitigate the downside? So again, a really useful exercise to go through as part of your strategic planning, which I would encourage you to do at least once a year, preferably twice a year. So very, very, very important. So the fourth and final part of the scaling framework, as I mentioned earlier, is the ability to execute on our plans consistently. And I mentioned earlier in the podcast that this is a massive strategic advantage. It's huge. And so if you look at any good business in the world, the ability to execute is a hallmark of their existence. Their ability to execute is what sets them apart from their rivals. Their ability to execute is based on clarity and focus, which is where the strategic plan comes in. So what happens with most businesses is they find it hard to stick to things. And it's the same with human beings at the individual level. All we need to do is think about New Year's resolutions. I'm recording this in early 2019, and there's been a plenty of New Year's resolutions being made, and I guarantee you that a lot of those resolutions would have been broken already. Now, I'm not saying that to be negative. It's just that that's the way human beings are. And I was talking to my personal trainer the other day, and he was telling me that the spike in gym memberships around New Year is phenomenal. And people find it hard to stick with things. Now, again, the reason people find it hard to stick at things or to get things done is A, they lack clarity, as I mentioned earlier, and B, they tend to take on too many things at one time. And let me give you an analogy. If I was to throw you a tennis ball, I guarantee you, you'd all catch it. If I was to throw you two tennis balls, you'd probably catch both of them, one in each hand. If I threw you three tennis balls, you might catch one or two and drop one, and that's fine. But if I threw you 10 tennis balls at once, chances are you're going to drop every single one of them because there's too much input, there's too much coming your way at once, and we get confused and we don't catch anything. And it's the same when we take on too much work or too many projects at any given time. What happens is our brains tend to fritz out a little bit, and we get into this state where we're overwhelmed, and so we don't do much at all, or we do little bits of everything and never really complete anything. So one of the sayings that I love is to stop starting things and start finishing things. And so with the process that we use around this, particularly for projects, is this Kanban methodology, which is a lean manufacturing methodology popularized in post-war Japan with the Toyota company. And really the fundamentals of Kanban, you can read up about it. It's very well known. But the couple of fundamentals around Kanban is, firstly, limit your work in progress. Really key important. Don't try and catch 10 tennis balls. Catch one or two and no more than three things on the go at any one time. So in our business, we try to have one or two things tops, and that's it. And even three for us is often too many to juggle. So it's, again, limiting work in progress. The second tenet of Kanban, of course, is to visualize your workflow. So we use Kanban boards to, you know, see clearly what's to be done, what is in process, and what's already been completed. And that gives us a huge ability to communicate with as a team about what we're doing, what needs to be done, and of course what's been completed. And we've found that when we do that, we can measure throughput, we can measure workflow, and we can get a lot more stuff done. And the third tenet of Kanban, of course, is it's a pull system rather than a push system. So as our bandwidth frees up, we take on more work rather than piling more stuff onto our plate. So it's about keeping the plate optimally filled, not overfilled, and that's really, really key. So another key challenge when it comes to getting stuff done and executing, I've already mentioned the fact that we, you know, take on too much. The second thing is we spend energy on the wrong things. And if we're climbing our ladder enthusiastically, but the ladder is up the wrong tree, well, really, it just means we're going in the wrong direction faster. And so it's very, very important to make sure that whatever we spend our energy on, we just critically think about whether that particular activity, that particular project, that particular element of the business, whether what we're doing is going to move the needle in a meaningful way, whether we're going to get progress, whether we're going to get traction. And so consistent execution is fundamental. So again, remembering that consistent execution is a strategic advantage, remembering that the key problems when it comes to execution is taking on too much and not being clear about where you're going, what you're doing, and ultimately what activities, what projects are going to give you the biggest return on your energy, the biggest return on your investment. And so that when we have that lack of clarity, we can run the risk of spending energy and time and resource on the wrong activities. So guys, that's the four-step framework for you. As I mentioned to you earlier, it really comes back to the ability to build assets. It comes back to the ability to build and lead a self-managing team. It comes back to strategic planning and getting clarity and focus around what you're doing. And then it comes back to critically, or being able to execute really, really well and consistently. So those are the fundamentals around scaling your dental practice. So again, guys, I mentioned to you earlier that if you want to go from a practice that is profitable but key person dependent to a practice that is scalable or valuable, the thing to be able to think about is, how do I take that transition? How do I change gear? And the framework I've just given you there is the gear change. That's what allows you to change gear and continue to accelerate. And so really the work that we do with all our clients is helping them make that gear change. And it sounds so simple, but it's not as easy as it first sounds, because it takes discipline, it takes focus, and of course structure and discipline are the price of entrepreneurial success. So having the structure in place and having the discipline to follow it is what's required to really make that transition from an operator style business to an ownership style business, where you move from just having money as a currency to having money and time as currency, so that you've got more money, more time, more meaning and more freedom in your life, and ultimately creating a practice and a life that you love. So that's really the scaling process outlined there for you. We've covered that in the two-part series there. As always, if you have questions or comments, we'd love to see you in the Facebook group. Feel free to come and ask me a question anytime. I'm more than happy to help you there. But in the meantime, take good care, have a lovely week ahead, and I look forward to seeing you next week on the podcast. All right, guys, take care. Bye now.
Thank you for listening to the Savvy Dentist podcast with Dr. Jesse Green. For more free tools and resources, join the free Facebook group. Visit drjessegreen.com/Facebook. And for more episodes, visit drjessegreen.com/savvydentist.